Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. This week, I'm just back from vacation. The break was really nice, but I'll confess that by the end of it, I was ready to return. Work gives my life a certain structure, and at the end of most days, a sense of accomplishment. I might fantasize about a life of leisure, but I don't really want it. Of course, for most of human history, this hasn't been a problem for almost anybody. The basic tasks of survival have kept us busy from sunrise to sundown. Yet we may be approaching an unprecedented era when most of us won't need to do much work at all, because technology can do our jobs better, faster, and cheaper than we can. And the big question is, would this make us happier than ever or terminally miserable? Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. His article, A World Without Work, appears in the July-August issue of the magazine, and we were so intrigued by the issues he raises that we invited him here to talk about it. Derek, welcome to Think.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
You opened the piece in Youngstown, Ohio, which lost a lot more than economic prosperity in the late 70s when its steel mills went dark.
That's right. I went to Youngstown because what I was looking at, the end of work, is for the United States still very much a futuristic concept. But for Youngstown, which in many ways is sort of a metaphor for this middle class that we worry about, it is a moment in history. It was in 1977 that this city, which used to be one of the richest in the country with one of the highest rates of home ownership in the country, this city essentially saw its largest mills shut down. It began a period of what economists called regional depression. And as you said, it wasn't just the jobs that went away. It wasn't just the money. It was a kind of community spirit that began to dissipate. You saw crime rates go up. They stopped building commercial buildings and started building prisons. You found that people who could afford to move away did move away, and a certain rate of poverty began to settle in to the city. So that, you know, being there now, 3.5 decades later, it's rather amazing the way that the people have evolved to meet their challenges. But as you said, and this is very much one of the major themes of the piece, work is not just money. Work is not just time and activity. It's also meaning and purpose. And when work leaves a place, something else is lost as well.
A shift like the one that took place in Youngstown might seem impossible to those of us in metropolitan areas with really diversified economies, but a surprisingly large number of occupations are poised to be supplanted by robots and computers, at least in part.
Yeah, there was this study from Oxford that looked at every single occupation that exists in the U.S. and determined that 47% of them, so about half of them, will be automatable in the next 2 decades. Now, that doesn't mean that those jobs are going to go away entirely. It simply means that these scientists projected that technology would be able to do those sort of tasks in 20 years. So, one way that I look at it to really make this point specific is to say, well, what are the most common jobs in the U.S. right now? They are cashier, retail salesperson, food and beverage worker, and office administrator. When you add a lot of different kind of jobs together, you have this larger category of driving, taxi drivers, truckers, which in fact is the largest occupation among American men. So you look at all of these jobs, these five jobs or sort of mega job categories, and you think, is there technology that exists that could begin to replace them? And I think you have to conclude that the answer is yes. We obviously can think of ways that various cashiers can be replaced by those checkout screens, or at least that a store that used to need 20 cashiers might only need 10 if they employ this technology. As more shopping goes online, you're going to need fewer people in the brick and mortar stores as retail salespeople. As certain parts of the food and beverage business are automated, you might need fewer people behind the counter. And then office administration is already, I think, being disrupted by software technology. And then finally, you have cars. And, Uber and Google are talking about developing their own self-driving cars, which would certainly displace a certain number of workers. So I do think that even as you said, in a city with lots of diversity in its job base, one can still be worried.
You cite an astonishing comparison between the biggest U.S. company of the mid-20th century, which was AT&T, and today's telecom giant, Google. Do you know those numbers offhand? I have them here.
I do know the numbers offhand. Yeah. So I'm trying to make the point that workers today, because of the technology available to them, can simply create so much more productivity. So in 1964, the nation's most valuable company was AT&T. It was worth about $270 billion in today's dollars, and it employed almost 800,000 people. Today's communications giant, Google, is actually worth now, I believe, over $400 billion and has 90% fewer employees. So right there, you see that we can create an enormous amount of wealth, a great amount of productivity, a large amount of services with fewer people employed full-time by the companies responsible for those services. And when you spill this out a little bit and imagine a lot of the labor-efficient companies of today replacing the less labor-efficient legacy companies of yesterday, you could see a future that required fewer full-time people employed as a share of the total population.
And we can continue to see GDP growing at a decent clip and yet have a smaller percentage of that GDP being paid out as wages.
That's right. And indeed, we are seeing just that as well. You know, I want to distinguish between the prediction that I make in the piece of declining full-time work with what we've seen in the last 5 years, which is a fairly steady labor recovery. It's absolutely true that since the end of the Great Recession, we have seen, particularly in the last 2 years, about 180,000 to 200,000 jobs being created per year, per month, which is a decently healthy. What we tend to see, though, historically, is that the greatest changes to the labor force don't happen during recoveries. They happen during recessions. And so this is one where I am not writing this piece suggesting that in the next 6 months, we're going to be seeing all sorts of incredibly dramatic changes to the labor force. That simply doesn't happen during thermostatic recoveries like this one. Rather, wait till for the aftermath of the next recession and the recession after that. Those are the periods that we're truly going to see large-scale changes to the labor force.
We've heard before about the end of work and computers and machines taking over, but it hasn't happened in the past. What makes this moment, though, different?
This is a great question, and it's one that I tried to deal with very upfront in the piece. I said, you know, I am not making this prediction for the first time in history. This is a prediction that was made implicitly by the Luddites who smashed their textile machines. It was made in the 1930s by John Maynard Keynes, who predicted that within 100 years we'd have a 15-hour work week. This was a prediction made both excitedly and with fear in the 1960s again, when you saw manufacturing being automated, robots entering the warehouses. And every single time, it has seemingly been proved wrong. And so in the piece, I call this the boys who cried robot, that we seem to find, you know, the same economists saying generation after generation, this revolution is just around the corner, and indeed it is not. I should say with this, you know, metaphor of the boys crying robot, in The Boy Who Cried Wolf, the wolf does come at the end, and no one believes him. And I do think that we are going to see technology begin to have play a greater role in displacing full-time work more permanently, perhaps through unobvious means. So the obvious way that we can imagine this happening is that we take a look at the technology that exists, like a checkout screen for a cashier, and we say, well, this will simply start to take over more cashier jobs. And sure, that's fine. And software is dexterous, and it can do a lot of things. But what I'm more interested in, and what I think is more likely, is that there are changes that we still can't quite imagine. So, for example, if you go back 10 years and say, you know, within 10 years, I think that a company that uses cell phone technology is going to be the biggest hotel operator in the world, someone's going to look at you like they have no idea what you're talking about. But indeed, Airbnb does use mobile technology in order to help people essentially make their apartments and their homes hotels and commoditize trust and become essentially an accommodation company. In 2004, I love this example. In 2004, some economists who were extremely bullish on the future of robots taking over jobs said, well, even as we can imagine machines doing lots of things that people do today, one thing we know they cannot do, machines cannot do, is drive a car. left-hand turns are way too complicated when you think about the visual intelligence and the timing and all of the recognition software to see what kind of sign is that, what does that light mean, is that even a light or is it just a bunch of circles in the air? It was less than 12 months later, yes, less than a year later, that the current head of Google's self-driving car division won a DARPA contest, a DARPA obstacle course with a self-driving car he helped develop at Stanford. So this prediction did not last the calendar year. And I think that we're more likely to see examples like that to either replace full-time work or ebb away at the idea of full-time work by, for example, turning full-time taxi jobs into part-time Uber jobs.
And interestingly, in the case of the Google self-driving car, they came out just last week saying, yes, our self-driving cars have been in some accidents, but none of them have been the fault of the technology itself. Now, I can't verify that, but that's at least what the company is claiming.
Yeah, and this gets into a really interesting discussion, which is the psychology of self-driving cars. Because people, you know, I think, 32,000 people died on the road last year. And if self-driving cars truly are safer, then this is a win-win-win-win to have fewer people at the wheel, having more time to be doing other things in the car, and the car itself driving more safely than with a human in the driver's seat. And it's possible that in 20 years we look back and say, can you possibly believe that we allowed crazy people to drive cars? It's possible. At the same time, you know, I think about the transition and what happens when the first self-driving car kills a person or is in some accident, and something like this is inevitable. And you think about how airplanes, which in many ways are partially automated and have been partially automated for the last few decades, when there's an airplane crash, people go berserk, and it's all over the news. It's on CNN and MSNBC for you know, 72 consecutive hours, wall-to-wall coverage. But flying in an airplane is safer than walking. So the fear comes not from comes partially from the lack of control. And this is sort of a meta issue that I think we might see if robots are taking more jobs, is that we don't have people at the proverbial driver's seat of occupations that used to be human-based. And how does that change the way that we think about safety and competence?
And of course, lots of people think, well, you know, maybe nobody's making wagon wheels anymore, but people moved into other occupations. But you point out so smartly in the piece that the automobile put a lot of horses and mules out of work. And in fact, a lot fewer exist today than did a century ago.
Yeah, this is really interesting, is that, you know, for many centuries, the horse was probably the second most important species in the economy. It plowed. It was necessary for not only agriculture, but also when we went to war, fielding the cavalry. And for many centuries, we invented things that we could put on the horse, things that were sort of horse supplementing technologies, stirrups and things like this. But suddenly we invented things that didn't make the horse more productive. It made the horse obsolete. We invented tractors and cars and tanks. And after tractors rolled onto American farms in the early 20th century, the population of horses and mules fell by 90% in the next four decades. And so the thinking is this could potentially happen to people as well.
Derek Thompson is my guest. He's senior editor at The Atlantic. His article, A World Without Work, appears in the July-August issue of the magazine. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, or you can email think@kera.org. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Derek Thompson, who is senior editor at The Atlantic and author of the article A World Without Work that appears in the July-August issue of The Atlantic. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, Derek, so it's really easy for us to fantasize about all the awesome things we'll do in retirement, assuming that we have enough money to support ourselves and our health is pretty good. As it turns out, though, retirees who don't have to work spend a lot of time, like, on the couch watching TV.
That's right. And, you know, one of the questions that I wanted to answer with this piece that's really difficult to answer is, does work make us happy? Now, let me say a few things about the question itself, and then I'll try to answer it. There's lots of different kinds of work. Some people adore their jobs. I'm very lucky to be able to write and think for a living. Many jobs are terrible. Many jobs are unbelievably boring and are drudgery and make people miserable at work. And, you know, there's been Gallup studies that suggest that up to 70% of people aren't satisfied in their current jobs. This leads sometimes to make people think that what would be better is a life of leisure. The problem here is that as anybody who has gotten bored and anxious on a too long Sunday or Saturday afternoon can attest, sometimes we can miswant too much leisure. So there's this wonderful study in the 1980s in Chicago where Csikszentmihalyi asked people at work and at leisure, do you wish you were somewhere else? And the people at work said, yes, I wish I was somewhere else. And the people at leisure said, no, I don't. But then he asked both groups to fill out diaries, real-time questionnaires, essentially, to document their levels of anxiety and the number of positive feelings they were having. And it turned out that the people, at least according to the diaries, seemed much better off at work when their time was structured, when they were surrounded by the camaraderie of the water cooler, when they could have time, ironically, complaining with their friends at work about work. And so this is what some psychologists call miswanting. It is possible to miswant too much leisure and to be made rather miserable by having nothing to do. And so as we grapple with the possibility that full-time work could dissolve in the face of lots of technology that does our jobs better than we could, we should also think about not only the public policy solution of how do we make sure that the fruits of such a economy can be more equally shared, but also think about what can these people do with their time that is more valuable not only than doing nothing, but also maybe than the bad jobs that they have now.
Have you seen the documentary Born Rich?
I have not.
Okay. It was made in 2003, I believe, by a young 20-something heir to the Johnson & Johnson fortune. And it followed a number of young people who were so wealthy they would never have to work. I think there was a Trump daughter in there and some other people. One of the subjects, I think the father of the filmmaker, had lived this life of leisure, and he seemed like a shadow of a person. He had everything that most of us think we're working for, like he got to spend his day oil painting and doing collections of expensive things. He didn't have work itself, and he just didn't seem very happy.
It's interesting. So in the piece, what I say is that you know, contentment is something that seems very much spoken in the present tense, but there's something more than contentment that people seek. Pride, purpose, meaning. All these qualities are only really felt, I think, when we have the occasion to reflect on what we've done. And so this is one of those cases where if you ask someone what do you want to do for the next hour, and they say, you know, watch Netflix, completely reasonable answer for how to spend your next hour. But hours become days and days become weeks. And if all you've done over a 3-week period in the summer is watch Netflix, it seems possible to me like you are not going to feel as proud about your time spent. as somebody who had the same choice about something very difficult. You know, do you want to help build this house for the next hour? No, that sounds exhausting and sweaty and hurtful to my bones. But after 3 weeks, you look back and you've built a house. And so I think that, you know, in thinking about sort of the positive psychology of happiness, which, you know, might sound a little bit frou-frou, but I think is very much a part of this question of, you know, the meaning of life and what can we do in a world without work, it turns out that many people reach in the short term for the easy thing, but it is the harder thing that in the long term makes us happier.
What do you think happens to consumption? If we're working less, will we consume less?
This becomes a major question and begins to introduce the issue of government intervention in an economy that like the one that I'm imagining. So on the one hand, we have today a consumer economy, an economy based on people who work full-time and in exchange for that work get a salary from their employer and spend that salary on stuff that employs other people. And so there's this virtuous cycle. In the world that I have imagined here and that other people have imagined as well, that a bit of that virtuous cycle begins to break down because if people aren't working full-time for employers, then they're not getting as much money, which means they have less money to spend, which means that the industries that service the mid-market mass consumer demographic are considerably weaker. I should say this is not merely something that I'm inventing a whole cloth. Fascinatingly, I recall, I believe it was the beginning of 2014, the payroll tax cut from the Obama administration had just been eliminated, and Walmart, at the end of that calendar year's first quarter, had a terrible handful of months. And the CEO, if I recall correctly, said one of the reasons we think that we had such a bad few months is that the government essentially stopped giving money to people. What I'm imagining here is that sort of situation potentially on steroids, that the government would have to essentially tax the owners of capital in the economy, find a way to redistribute it, potentially in the form of a universal basic income, which is essentially like Social Security for everybody, redistribute the money throughout the economy in order to ensure that you still have a consumer economy functioning. The major difference here, and a major complication, I should say, is that when you get your money from the employer, there's no real question of politics. But when you're getting your money from the government, the redistribution of national income becomes a question of politics, which means it is enormously fraught with moral debates. And that's why, even as I think there's all sorts of ways for this world without work scenario to be better for lots of people, given the right governmental provisions, getting there could be a nightmare.
There will still be some people who have to work. There will be some jobs that have to be, you know, somebody has to invent technology, somebody has to maintain it, somebody has to, you know, keep certain services going. What's interesting is this question of, you know, if we have like a universal basic income, I, like you, love my job. I love coming to work every day. But I've wondered if money were literally no object, you know, after three bad days in a row, does everybody just throw up their hands? What do you think would happen to motivation?
That's a great question. So on the one hand, one of the beautiful things about a universal basic income is that it gives people the ability to reject terrible jobs that pay terribly. On the other hand, what you're asking is there a moral virtue to sort of sticking through with hard tasks at work that teaches you something for the future? I think there absolutely is. I should say, I don't think I envision, and I don't think most people envision, a universal basic income that is so generous that it completely obviates work. I think that there will always, first of all, be people with full-time jobs. I think that I also think that it's difficult to imagine what some of those full-time jobs are going to be. Some of them are going to be in industries that don't exist. But I do think that there are a lot of people, sort of, you know, today's cashiers and retail salespeople and food and beverage workers, who might be displaced. And the universal basic income is essentially a poverty mitigating policy. It is not, the purpose is not to give someone so much money that they should be perfectly comfortable on the couch for their 35 primetime years, but rather that that amount of money is enough to avoid widespread indigence. I think it's a slightly different bar that I'm trying to hit.
So there's this idea of people being able to create things. If they've got a basic guaranteed income, they know that they'll be able to put a roof over their heads and some food on the table. Maybe we have a lot of people who right now are, behind a cash register that would love to write a novel or, sculpt something amazing. Can you talk a little bit about the potential for artisans and craftspeople surprisingly having a real renaissance in a time when everything else is done by machines?
Yeah, so, it's interesting when you look at this from a historical standpoint that artisans were in many ways the original American middle class. They were the silversmiths and the blacksmiths and the woodworkers who were displaced by the Industrial Revolution, the era of mass manufacturing in the late 19th and early 20th century. And the prediction that I'm making now is that the same essentially the rest of the economy faces that demise, that the technology can continue to do more jobs and replace more jobs just as it replaced the silversmiths. In a weird way, I think that it's possible the pendulum might swing back, and that in a world in which we're sort of surrounded by abundance and software, that there will be a renewed interest and a renewed sort of luxury in things that are specially made by people. And the nice thing about this, not only is there a lot of just positive psychology that suggests that making things with your hands, making things whose outcome you can see, it's just very good for the soul. But also, I in this piece, I visited a maker's space in Columbus to take a look at, what this might look like. A maker's space is essentially like a gymnasium for tools. It's a place where people go to essentially work as silversmiths and blacksmiths, and they paint and they teach classes, and there are people there who just go to learn a certain skill. It struck me as a really sort of beautiful community. And when I talked to people there and I told them about sort of the piece that I was working on and the future that I was predicting, some of them said, I can't imagine that future coming. But a lot of them said, I can imagine it coming. I hope it comes. Because to me, the ability to make just a little bit amount of money and to spend lots of my time doing something creative, doing the thing that is my passion and my calling, that to me is utopia.
And for those who don't have such a passion, there might be a value to something like playing a video game that provides, frankly, a reward for something that's not real, but still makes one feel like, you have met a goal.
Yeah, so on the one hand, my hope, not to be overly paternalistic, but I guess only to be slightly paternalistic, my hope is that this future, if it comes, does not result in lots of people just staying at home playing video games. I feel like the flourishing of the human spirit is a little bit bigger than that. But that said, there have been fears that during recessions we would see crime spike to an enormous extent. And in the Great Recession, crime did not. Violent crime, in fact, continued to fall. And a couple economists have a theory that they're sort of working on that said that, one of the reasons it didn't fall was because there's so much cheap entertainment. It is so easy to stay entertained at home. And as a result, one can imagine lots of people, with our slavish devotion to screens, people playing games in communities where essentially they can get a measure of pride, whether it's a World of Warcraft community or some other, massive multiplayer online community, where they essentially become known for a certain skill. And sure, someone could criticize and say that skill is not real. That skill is, the ability of a pixelated avatar of you defeating gargoyles. It's not necessarily the same as making writing a novel. But you know, from a psychological perspective, I think it's sort of a worthy and interesting question to say, well, why not? If writing a novel and getting feedback from people reading your work, is that so dissimilar from achieving greatness in an online gaming community? If your hormones are firing the exact same way in terms of, you know, pride and satisfaction and reward and accomplishment and mastery and belonging to a certain community that respects your work, I do think it's an interesting question and to ask, and maybe one that we'll increasingly ask, is have we been wrong to disparage the psychology of gamers simply because it has seemed weird to the mainstream that somebody would sort of sit on their couch and mash buttons all day?
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Paul is on the line in McKinney. Hello, Paul.
Yes. I guess I got a couple of questions, and I don't know if they're related, but one is there's this issue of the percentage of people that are actually in the workforce, and there have been some concern over the last couple of reports on unemployment that the number of people that are actually working is dropping, and there's like a whole bunch of discussion about why are people leaving the workforce. On the other hand, you've got this other issue where you've got all these jobs being created that nobody is able to fill because they don't have the skills to fill those jobs. And is there, I don't know if there's a connection between the two, but the main thing I was thinking about, though, and the main question I had was the size of the population and the amount of jobs in that population, especially if you're talking about a global economy where you've got so many jobs that are they exportable, et cetera.
Yeah, so it sounds like we're talking about three different issues here, but I can sort of run through them as fast as possible. Let me start with the third. The third issue that we're talking about is offshoring or globalization. I do not talk about offshoring or globalization that much in the piece, but I don't want that to be confused with the fact that I think that globalization doesn't matter. It's obviously had an enormous role on decreasing the number of manufacturing workers that we have in the U.S. We've been able to take those jobs and put them overseas. Certainly the same with you know, with textile workers and things like this. And globalization will continue to play a large role, I'm quite certain. The first and second issue is participation rate. The participation rate has dropped by quite a bit, and it is a little mysterious to some people why so many are left out. The final thing is a skills mismatch. I don't have enough time, I think, to get into this. It's a really thorny issue, and economists are, I think, a little bit confused about whether or not there is or is not a skills mismatch in the economy.
We'll take a quick break and come back to our conversation with Atlantic senior editor Derek Thompson. His article, A World Without Work, appears in the July-August issue of the Atlantic magazine. Join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Atlantic senior editor Derek Thompson. His article, A World Without Work, appears in the July-August issue of the magazine. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. And that's where we hear Derek from Devon in Fort Worth, who says, "What do the inventors of all this wonderful technology have against people? I much prefer a real human sales clerk, admin person, waiter, etc., to dealing with a robot and its technology."
That's a big question. I think I'm interpreting the question correctly when I say what do technologists have something against people?
Mm-hmm.
Is that
That's what I'm guessing, or why? Okay. Why think it's better to use a robot than a person?
Sure. Well, you know, there are some things that robots simply do better than people. There are some tasks that absolutely should be automated, and lots of software companies that are very wisely automating those tasks in order to create a product, whether it's a financial services product or something like Uber or something like Airbnb, that makes something faster, more efficient, cheaper. This is something that consumers want, and we know that they want it because millions of them use these apps. So in that respect, the technologists are absolutely right. I do think, however, that, you know, even wonderful intentions can have side effects that are either unexpected or expected and bad. And one of the possible side effects of this is that lots of extremely successful and wonderful technology is nonetheless displacing of human labor. Displacing of it either because it replaces full-time jobs with software entirely, or by sort of modularizing full-time jobs, like, say, a taxi driver, and turning it into a bunch of drives sort of executed by dozens of Uber drivers. So I think that, you know, I don't think that technologists are antisocial or pathologically crazy. I think that they're often doing their job very well, and that often their very well-done job can have negative side effects.
I'm wondering about what effect this would have on our approach to education, which in recent decades has become so much a commodity, higher education in particular. We no longer think of going to college simply because it'll make us richer human beings. We go because it will make us wealthier human beings.
This is a huge question. Okay, so here's two ways that I think about it. The first way that I think about it is technology helping education, and then technology hurting the impetus to get an education. So technology helping education. You know, right now, I think there are a lot of classes that are essentially taught in a manner with a lecturer at the front of a theater with 300 students. That's more or less indistinguishable from the way that, you know, Plato or Aristotle might have lectured a couple millennia ago. So obviously there hasn't been an enormous amount of technological change happening there. And people are asking the question, all right, is there a better way to teach? Is there a way to teach that we can, you know, give so-called superstar teachers a portal, a platform to the world, match that with a sort of instructors at the local level so that we maintain the human touch of a classroom. They essentially find a more efficient, more technologically savvy way to teach and to monitor student progress and to test. And this is a fascinating idea that I don't get into in the piece, but what I think is well worth thinking about, and some people are thinking about it really hard. On the other hand, here's the downside. The downside is that in this world that I've imagined, in which there are fewer full-time jobs waiting for people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, et cetera, this does somewhat chop the head off one of the most important impetuses to get an education, which is to get a full-time job. And there's a writer, Martin Ford, who wrote a great book, The Rise of the Robots, who made this point to me. He said, you know, it seems conceivable that if I'm right, and robots do take a lot, or machines, software automation takes lots of full-time jobs, fewer people see the need to go to college, or even necessary, even possibly to finish high school. But the interest of the government and of citizens in an educated citizenry will live on. And so what happens when the government has, you know, wants people to stay educated, but people don't see enough of a reason to stay educated? Will people be paid to go to school? Will paying people to go to school be seen as a civic duty of government to make sure that people don't sort of drop out of their studies just because there aren't necessarily full-time jobs waiting for them at the end of that that escalator of education? It's a tough question, and not one that I can answer right now, but I can absolutely see technology sort of on both sides of this question.
Assuming for the sake of argument, Derek, that this does happen, that far fewer of us find full-time employment, find lifelong employment, but are able to sustain ourselves, do you think American culture will have a tougher time adjusting to this than, say, like the sort of quasi-socialist structures that exist in Northern Europe?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I think that America in many ways is sort of we're the worker bees of the industrialized world. Since the middle of the 20th century, hours worked per year per full-time worker have fallen about 15% in the U.S. Most of that decline happened before 1980, but about 15% in the U.S. It's fallen, though, by 50% in some Central European countries like Germany and the Netherlands. So obviously, there are some countries that have used their richness, that have used their increased productivity to buy more leisure time, essentially. They've said, all right, well, this is as rich as I want to get, and now that I can get that rich by working fewer hours, I'll simply take those hours and go on vacation, or I'll take them and have more leisure time, spend more time with my family. In the U.S., however, not only hours have only fallen by 15% in the last six decades, they've fallen by a lot among lower-income people who have had a harder time finding full-time work already, and sort of the full-time work offered by manufacturing has been replaced by work in retail shops, which is often part-time. There are, however, among the 10% of the richest 10% of the country is actually working harder than we used to. So very weirdly, America's richest people have responded to greater productivity by doing the exact opposite of what Keynes predicted they would do, whatever it was, 80 years ago, when he said a more productive country will work less. In fact, if you're rich in America, the more productive you get, the harder you work. What sense does that make if you're on this hedonic treadmill? Well, it only makes sense if there is honor in work, maybe if you love your job, if you feel like you're in a global rat race with international competition, all sorts of reasons. But you know, this question of why is work so specifically an American religion, this is a tough one.
What do you think it would take to open ourselves up to a new, I guess, embrace of playfulness as a value in life?
Oh, boy. The question essentially is, how does culture change? I guess the answer is slowly. The most likely scenario to me is that we don't see this future arrive overnight. It's not a storm. It's gonna be a slow burn. That we begin to see opportunities for full-time work decline. That there is will potentially be a phase where politics will denigrate people who don't work, will have an uncomfortable time dealing with an elevated unemployment rate, but that over time we will find both political and cultural solutions to a permanently elevated unemployment rate, and that in particular, because some of those people who are working less will be younger people. Not only will they potentially create a cultural norm that older people can sort of learn from, they'll grow up, and they'll grow up with a diminished expectation of what is now the American religion of full-time work. And they'll teach their children the new culture, and their children will teach their children the new culture. And so only in time will we sort of have the structural change that we're talking about. I do think the transition is going to be messy, though, and I don't see any way that people embrace a world without work future automatically.
It feels like some of that shift is already taking place among millennials. In some ways, it's really delightful. In other ways, it concerns those of us who are, you know, members of older generations. I'm so curious, though, as to whether, like, does adolescence now last, or will it last in the future till 35? Is that when people figure, okay, now it's time for me to, like, move out of mom and dad's and get a life of my own?
Right. Yeah. So I do think the what has happened to young people, 20 somethings, in the last 7 years is both a result, I think, of maybe some technological change, but also just the outcome of a remarkably terrible recession.
Yeah.
It is possible that, yes, that some of the cultural values shared by 20-somethings today will be America's cultural values tomorrow, that they won't grow up and adopt so-called adult values, but that adults will adopt so-called millennial values of not necessarily preferencing money over all, valuing a work-life balance, elevating healthy living to be one of the pillars of sort of a happy life. It is completely possible that these aren't just fads, that they are sort of lasting trends. But one needs the perspective of, I think, a few more decades to be absolutely sure about that.
For people who deliberately stayed in Youngstown, even after things got tough economically, why do they tell you they stayed?
Sometimes they stayed because they couldn't afford to leave. some of the people, some of the richest people in Youngstown were the first to leave when they realized everything was falling apart. And this is one of the reasons why the wages, average wages, have dropped so much in the city, and there is such widespread poverty. But one thing that I thought was interesting, and this very much goes to sort of the larger point of the piece and what we've been talking about, changing expectations and changing culture. You know, in talking to people who were not making a lot of money, but nonetheless didn't seem despondent about their lives, had grown, had enough time to sort of adjust to the new normal in their city. And what's interesting to me about how they adjusted is, you know, typically when someone goes to, let's say, a party or a gathering, a meeting, and you say, you know, what do you do? The person says one thing. I host a radio show. I write for a magazine. I work in marketing. I work in retail. In Youngstown, the answer to the question, what do you do, doesn't seem to be one thing. It seems to be lots of things. I'm a bartender. I'm a poet. I'm a musician. I grow vegetables in urban gardening. I fix people's cars. A host of things that we consider both artsy and practical and masculine and feminine. And so the sense of pride that one draws singularly from that one thing that we do in most of the country, the pride seems to be drawn from the resourcefulness. And that is an interesting way, I think, to look at pride and work, saying that I am defined not by the thing that I do, but by the things that I do and by my ability to do things, plural. This is something that, once again, I think you pointed this out a little bit. You said that maybe the millennial generation will sort of point older generations or future generations towards this new future. And you do see that a lot of younger people, at least there is this idea of them, you know, working for Uber and working as baristas and doing something creative on the side and having this sort of mishmash of gigs and part-time jobs and freelance opportunities and contingent work for on-demand companies. And making things work by doing lots of things. It's possible that something more like that, something more freelance and part-time, will be the future. I think that it will take some time to know for sure from the government data that this is a trend that's catching on. But I can absolutely see it happening.
And you touch on this briefly in the piece. There might also be more time to perform the kinds of care that we now outsource because every adult is working full time. Things like caring for young children, caring for elderly or infirm relatives, that might once again fall more to family members than to outsiders who are paid.
Yeah, I think, for example, you know, the way that today's economy works, even though it is efficient, obviously does not reward the most important jobs necessarily with the most money. Some of the most important things that one can do in this world, raising a child, caring for the sick, teaching, are not rewarded generously with money if they're rewarded at all. Meanwhile, there's lots of jobs that one can tick through in the finance industry that might have a dubious benefit to the civic good of the country, but nonetheless earn people millions of dollars a year. So, you know, the economy is not a morality play. And it is true that in a world where people essentially could get a guaranteed income from the government and not live in poverty, that they might spend more time with family and might spend more time with their communities and might be good to one another. And that's a future to hope for, even as one is sort of understanding of all the challenges that a world without work would bring.
Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. His article, A World Without Work, appears in the July-August issue of the magazine. Derek, you've given us so much to think about. I really appreciate you making this time for us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. If you want to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.